everybody, you're tuning into Deeper Grooves, Musicians on Music, hosted by Cliff Beach and sponsored by California Soul Music Record Label. Today I'm nerding out because I get to talk with a guy who I'm a super huge fan of. He's a soul artist, Victor Duplay, all the way from the East Coast, here to talk about his album, Bold and Beautiful, which the single, Make a Baby, was nominated for a Grammy. Please help me welcome Victor.
Can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
I can.
Excellent.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Everything is great.
Super excited to get to chat with you. I mean, I've been a big fan. I met you like many years ago at one of the Kiss and Grind. So super stoked to have you on Deeper Grooves podcast today. And we're just going to ask you a couple of questions about your career and your music.
Okay, cool.
So I was introduced to you when you released your second album, Bold and Beautiful. And I remember that Garth Trinidad and KCRW were really championing that record at the time. And so I kind of want to know what your process was with creating that album.
That's some time now. It's just some years behind it. I mean, it's difficult to say what the process was for an album because it wasn't like I was standing still just making an album. Mm-hmm. I was just all over the place. So it kind of came together. It was supposed to be more like the first album, which was a little bit more experimental and experimenting with up-tempo energy and different things like that. But it just worked out like it kind of became really soulful and vibey. I think that was because of what was happening in the world at the time, where things were going. We're starting to head into that recession, and the mood was down. So I was just trying to find something that was sultry and vibey instead of party-based.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was definitely a great follow-up to your first record. On your first record, the debut, I thought it was a smash. You know, you had Morena and a lot of great tropical beats and things that were mixed in. I remember Looking for Love was also featured on the Delivering Us from Eva soundtrack. And so were you kind of approaching it any different, or was the process basically the same? Like, you still kind of go through how you're sourcing your content and samples and how you're recording your vocals, or was there kind of like from album to album, like a progression that you were trying to look for?
Well, it was different in the sense that the first album was a major label album, and I had a big budget, so there was a lot more collaboration. Musicians flying around the world, recording with different people. So I think the level of experimentation was a bit higher because of that, because when you add a lot of different people's perspectives and you have multiple points of view even in one song, you know? Then Bold and Beautiful was a bit more me and a producer or me and a co-writer type of thing coming up with everything. And I spent a lot of time writing and recording the songs by myself. Or I should say in very small environments, like one person, Sebastian, who wrote Make a Baby with me. And he had a small studio in Burbank. I was recording vocals at my friend's house in Hollywood Hills. It was just a different thing, just a different vibe.
Yeah, I remember Make a Baby was actually nominated for a Grammy around that time, too, for a category I don't believe they have anymore, for Best Urban Alternative Performance. And I was super excited for you. And so, like, when you're making the music, I mean, does that kind of notoriety matter to you? Or are you just like, I'm just trying to make the best thing that I can at that time?
Well, it's always nice to be celebrated. I just don't know that I would be shooting for that, because it's such a nondescript type of thing to say, I want to get a Grammy. I don't know how you try to get a Grammy. You know what I'm saying? I don't
right.
know how you do that. So it was a great, it was shocking to know that you get nominated as an independent artist. And pretty much everyone else in the category was a major label, I think. Well, maybe not, because I think Eric Roberson was in at that time, the same year as me. But it was just great to feel appreciation from your peers and be welcomed by people who appreciate what you do.
Definitely. And, you know, the Bold and Beautiful album also featured Ty Trippett, which I thought was a super interesting combination with you, although I know you did come from some kind of gospel underpinnings as a youth. And then the Canadian artist Estero was also on there, and Miss Saigon. So when you're kind of figuring out who you want to feature, are they coming in to write in the process, or do you have an idea in mind? You're trying to source like a certain voice or something to the music. How does that kind of work for you?
No, Ty Trippett was signed to my label. So James Poyser and I had a label, an independent, I'm sorry, a production company / imprint on Sony. And Ty Trippett was one of the artists that we signed. So they were just involved with some of the sessions that they were around. They were recording their first album around the time I was working on my album. And then the track with Estero, I think I had a skeleton of that track for like, I don't know, maybe 10 years. And we had never finished it. It was supposed to be, it was a demo that we cut for her one day. And she never did anything more than the hook. So then I wrote a song around it. So it wasn't like looking for collaborations per se. I don't think of that way. That was one of the struggles I had with the labels at the time. They were like, well, who's going to be your feature? Who's going to be this? I don't think about my own art with other people on it. I just do it for me. And if it just so happens to fit with somebody else, that's great. But if not, I don't worry about it too much.
Yeah, and you definitely heard that when you did the single Electric Love, which also I thought had just amazing synth sounds and stuff like that. How do you go about, because I know the sounds, especially in electronic music, are so important. Like, how do you go about figuring out like what the song needs based on the sound production?
It's just a feel thing, like anything else. You can come up with it right away, or you can take weeks and weeks of tweaking. In Electric Love's case, I took a lot of time. There's a lot of layers to that original version. I just took a lot of time trying to mix different things together to give me the feel that I wanted. But some of it is experimenting with technology. And that stuff from then to now was a lot harder to get that sound then than it is now, interestingly enough. Because people can make something on a telephone that sounds as good or better in terms of the textures, because the apps and the machines have gotten to be so great in the palm of your hand. But before, it took a long time to deal with synths and EQ, and you had to really know what you're doing. And I think a lot of people are getting away with murder right now, but it's okay. That's just where the world is.
Yeah, technology does advance. But not without its problems and stuff like that. So I guess kind of to go back to the precursors before some of your solo stuff, you've appeared on a lot of other records for people. I know you've done stuff with Jazzanova and with Erykah Badu and King Britt's Silk 130, Jamiroquai, Michelle and Degacello, Estero, the Clara Hill track you guys did. That stuff was amazing. And tons of other collaborations. And so is there a memorable or maybe a few kind of experiences and those kind of collaborations you could share?
Well, they're all different because I do different things. So sometimes I'm a producer, sometimes I'm a remixer, sometimes I'm a singer, sometimes I'm a writer. So it's tough to pull one of them out and say they're better or more profound than the other. I think the process of working with Clara and Jazzanova was probably, that was interesting because of the language barrier. And also, at that time, they hadn't done any vocalists. Jazzanova, I was the first singer that they worked with. So part of my mission was to teach them how to work with performers, because they had basically just been working on drum machines. They were making this really beautiful sound that everybody thought was live, but it was all samples. And I was teaching them how to deal with vocalists and how to record sessions and things like that. So that was great, just to be a part of the intercontinental creative connection, or whatever you want to call that, global synergy. And working with the Badus and the Eric Benet's, and that's a very different type of thing, because you're dealing with legendary talent. So that experience, those experiences are very different than the recording process with people who are drum machine based or something like that. It's like musicians and coordinating sessions and writing songs and major labels, and that part I don't love, having to deal with the A&Rs, and that part you can keep.
Yeah, the business part and the suits are definitely different than the artists and the vibe of what they're trying to do. And sometimes they conflict because, you know, the business is worried about the business. It's less about what it is than, like, you know, how they're going to market it and that kind of thing, and what their spin they're going to put on it or whatever. I think that's how.
I think the thing that's the most challenging when you work with major label artists, and this is something that James and I'm not going to say we disagreed on, but it became harder for me at a certain point in time. I don't like the process of working on things that you don't control. What I mean by that is you can come up with 7, 10, 15 songs or something with an artist. You can make decent money at it, which we were making great money at doing that part of it. But where it becomes frustrating is that at the end of that process, somebody else gets to say they don't want to use those songs, right? And it's not just that it's the songs, it's the time you put into it. That could take you 6 months or even in some cases a year working on an artist, working on a project, and then someone else decides to shelve it. So I got tired of that really quickly.
Yeah, I mean, songs are like your babies too, and it's like you don't want your baby not to grow up and get out there.
I just don't want my life. I don't want to make a conscious decision to spend a year in a studio and not be out exploring the world, and then somebody tell me that they're not going to put it out, or not even tell me anything. They just don't do it, and you never know why. And that started to be very frustrating to me.
Yeah, and you definitely don't get experiences or time back, and I think that's the commodity we're bartering with now, trying to really put our energy towards what matters the most, and that is tough, not to be able to have that control. And that's not the first time I'm hearing that from other artists working with, especially the majors. That happens quite a bit. Now, I know that you had some associations with early on with DJ Jazzy Jeff and Kenny Gamble, of, you know, very famous Philly producers. And I know you kind of split your time between Philly and Georgia growing up. So I wanted to learn a little bit about your kind of musical origins, like how you grew up and came into music, and then how you were associated with these producers and how that kind of helped your early on growth.
I spent most of my educational time in Philly, and my mom was a music teacher. So she didn't really teach me. I never learned any music from her per se, but there's music always around the house. So I went to music schools and did touring choirs and things as a kid. But my love for recording came from discovering DJ culture when I was about 10 or 11 or something like that. I started to DJ. I met Jazzy Jeff not too long after that, maybe around 12-ish in the neighborhood. So we just have a relationship that kind of goes beyond just the production. And then as we got older, I was making my own music and recording, and he was coming off tour, and he's like, "Yo, man, I have all this equipment. Let's hook up and start working together." And that's when we started A Touch of Jazz Productions, which went on to build the careers for Jill Scott and Music Soul Child and a bunch of other people. But one of the people we developed was James Poyser, and then James and I broke off to do our own production company, Axis Music. Kenny Gamble is just the giant mentor to all of us, and he took me under his wing for a period of about 3 years and wanted me to come down and just taught me everything, taught me the ins and outs of business, good, bad, and ugly. And he and the entire Philly International family, they're all like my uncles and aunts and big brothers and big sisters. They really raised us. Tough love. Definitely tough love.
Yeah. That's always needed. I mean, plus those people, when they're giants, I mean, they've seen it all. They've done it all. They know the ins and outs of everything. And I think everybody that kind of wants to be successful, when you really drill into them, have had someone that came and mentored them, if they were lucky enough to be able to find that. For the most part, I found that a lot to be true. Now, talking about the DJ culture, I wanted to get back into those Kiss and Grinds. I know I saw some in LA. Was that something that happened also, like, back in Philly where you were and other stuff? Like, can you kind of tell, like, the audience, for people who aren't familiar with it, like, what you guys were doing with Kiss and Grind at that time, and just DJ and DJ culture and your style of music?
Well, when I started to move to LA in the early 2000s, I found that LA had these really beautiful people, and you would see these pictures of these events, and it looked like, oh man, that must have been really cool because everybody was pretty and dressed sexy and blah, blah, blah. But when I was actually at those parties, I thought they were awful. I thought they were dead. I thought the music was trash. Nobody was really dancing. Everybody was looking at each other. They weren't touching. And I wasn't coming from that. I'm coming from a city where the people look cool, but really what they focus on when they go out is having a good-ass time, right? That's really what Philly music is about. It's about dancing, having fun. Your hair is messy. Your clothes, your suit sweated out. Whatever it is, no matter how you came in there, you know you're going to go out of there looking tore up, right? That's something that I wasn't seeing in a certain part of L.A. culture. I hate when people say L.A. I should say Hollywood, because people from L.A. do things a little differently, natives to L.A., but the Hollywood scene in general was really stiff, you know? And I was also traveling to all these different places, and I would see people from L.A., like Winter Music Conference or something like that, and they would be having a good time down there. But I was saying, well, why do we have to go to Miami to have fun? Or why do we have to go to Vegas to have fun? Why aren't we having fun in L.A.? So Kiss and Grind was something I started with Garth Trinidad. I told him, I said, man, we need to have an event that people can just go and listen to all this beautiful music that we're playing and making. He was a champion of all different kinds of soul music on KCRW, very influential in helping my career grow and a lot of the other soul artists, between Garth and the Temple Bar and all those things. And that's actually where we got the idea to bring DJ Rashida into it, because she was such a great selector down at the Temple Bar, and she has such a great vibe as a person. And we the first year or so, it was about celebrating soul music and not just being James Brown or Rare Grooves, but to go deeper into the artists and play their whole catalog. Kind of like what Soulection ended up doing later on. We were doing that specifically with no hip hop at first, on purpose, just to be different. Because I think at that time also there was a lot of murder happening at rap clubs in LA, a lot of shootouts. So we were just trying to create a vibe that everybody could get lost in. And we were really good at creating a very special moment in LA history because of the late night parties, starting the party at 11, going till 5, doing all the things that were very East Coast or very European that weren't really happening in LA. So that's kind of the roots of it. And as time is going on, we modified and started playing more hip hop, more Afrobeat, more reggae. Those weren't things that we were playing at first. Oh no, we were playing Afrobeat, but old school Afrobeat, Fela, and those kinds of things. But now we're playing a wider variety. But even still, when DJs come, I try to lean on them to stay in the R&B and soul and melodic music, and not get too lost in trying to appease a crowd that wants to turn up, because I don't really like the energy behind a lot of those songs.
I definitely agree. You guys had that kind of vibe, and I saw you at, I think it was Alcea when I saw one of the Kiss and Grind, but I love just that energy and vibe and the positivity and the eclectic nature of it, that, you know, you don't have to be pigeonholed as a soul artist, you know, bringing in those electronic elements, but like you said, not just James Brown and certain things that people are familiar with, but deeper cuts and deeper expressions of what that medium could do. Because I feel you can find soul in a great country song, perhaps, or something. You know, depending on the vibe, you can find different things in places that you wouldn't necessarily expect. And I think that's what Chocolate City and Garth Trinidad and you with Kiss and Grind were kind of able to do in like a really positive space. So because you do wear many hats, I saw also that you curated Bilal's mixtape, The Retrospection, and it features some of his unreleased material from Love for Sale. So because you're from Philly, obviously, I'm sure you had worked with Bilal and knew him, but that scene, you know, with the Jill Scotts and Tessa Jazz and stuff like that, like how was it kind of showcasing like another artist's basically musical life story?
Well, it's fascinating because a lot of us from that moment are close. We're friends, but the city doesn't really know. The city wasn't, how do I explain it? A lot of the artists who didn't break out like top 40, even Jill to a certain degree, the city of Philadelphia, the average person doesn't know about it. Like the average person doesn't know about the Five Spot and all those different things and Silk City where King was kicking it off. Like everybody didn't really know about it. Only a certain type of person. You had to be kind of really cool or into the arts or moving into that space that doesn't really cater to a mainstream energy. So some of these stories are tucked away in our minds because everybody else didn't see it, you know? So I think it's good to be able to support each other and continue the story going because some of these things are lost and really need to be talked about. And Bilal's an interesting case where he's got this massive talent, but he's made some tricky decisions or people have made decisions for him in terms of management and labels and things like that. So sometimes he wasn't really able to make the most of his opportunities and it's not necessarily any fault of his own. A lot of us have had careers like that where, you know, one false move and all of a sudden you're stuck in mud, right? But then the Jazzy Jeffs and the Fresh Princes and the Music Soul Childs who broke out and had more mainstream success and the Boyz II Men's and so on and so forth, they get embraced from a broader community. So there's a lot of other people to tell their story.
Right, right. Now, also talking about, you know, you being a remixer in certain projects, one of the most recent remixes that I heard from you was the By Fire remix on Hiatus Coyote's Recalibrations Volume 1. And I thought it was an amazing track. And I knew the original very well because I was super into their second album. And I wanted to know, like, how do you take the stems and flip a song to put your unique spin on it? Because it sounded very much like them, but also very much like you.
Well, that track was tough because I like you, I was a fan of that original song. But it's in a very odd time signature, if you know what time signature means. It's they had some strange, I shouldn't say strange, let's say unusual timing to it. So the one thing that I, as a fan, when I was listening to it, I was always saying, man, if this thing just had a little bit more groove to it, it would be amazing, right? If they just took that one extra beat that they put in there, I wonder why they did that. Because I've seen them perform and I understand that they don't necessarily perform for a dance floor. They're performing because of they're musicians and they like to play, right? So it's a different energy, a different design, I should say. But I didn't want to go in there and say, I want to play the chords differently or I want to do anything out of the ordinary. I just wanted to bring a pocket to it and make it so that the person could just continually groove with that hypnotic progression that they had and that really cool melody that she put down. That was my approach to that particular remix.
Yeah, I really love how, and I just noticed this for some reason, but I really love how you use the panning of those vocals in the very, very up top. And they're syncopated because of the way they're kind of pushing and pulling on each other. And so it's headphone candy where when you take off, you know, the left and the right, you listen to them independently and then you hear them together, like it builds, you can hear like all the layers and the thought of what you did to make that remix the way that it is. So I really appreciate that as a fan and musician. I was like really into your track out of all the ones that they had done on that Recalibration. Like I was really happy to see your name, but also hear
I always like remixes that enhance the song. And sometimes people feel like they have to put their own chords down, their own beat. I don't think that always enhances it. I mean, if you look back on 12-inch dance culture, disco records, sometimes the same song with just better EQ or one or two things taken out of the original version makes the song sound fresh, you know? And that's kind of how I like to approach remixes for the most part, unless the song is just not really that dope. But when a song is dope, it just needs a little boost, not a change, not a facelift.
Right. Yeah. And I definitely can hear that for sure in your remix. So I wanted to know, as we start to wrap up, like, what's next musically for Victor?
Well, I'm working on a lot of different things. Timelines are all jacked up now because of COVID, but
of course,
independent projects for myself, collaborations with different producers, talking about doing some things with Steve Lacy, with Black Coffee, with Ronnie Sides, with a lot of different artists. Just finishing now has been the challenge because we're all kind of compressed in our brains, and then having odd schedules because of just the unpredictability of what's been going on. But I've been really focused on getting things done and even putting some of my older things out with new versions. So that's kind of what I'm going to start to do this year.
Awesome. We definitely look forward to that. I mean, Steve Lacy and some of the people you named are like really top notch. And I see stuff from him all the time on different playlists on Spotify. And that'd be cool to kind of see what you guys can come to make some super dope stuff coming out. So then rapid fire, what advice would you give an up-and-coming artist that's starting out now as far as like what they should learn or what they should do first or how they should kind of get into their career?
What type of artist?
Like an artist in your lane, like a DJ, producer, or like a soul vocalist?
Well, you got to be specific. That's the main thing. And you have to become good at something. And I don't quite understand the people that, and I don't think anyone does, the people that get famous because they're famous. That's a new phenomenon since social media. And I think a lot of people are putting way too much emphasis on that process instead of finding, taking the time to put their head down and become really good at something to the point where they're undeniably good at it. And that means when your musicianship is at a super high level, your vocalizing is at a high level, your drum machine program is at a high level, no one will be able to deny you that. But if you base everything on hype, then you leave yourself open for frustration. But the main thing on top of that is whatever you're going to do, make sure you love it and you're not doing it for the money. Because if you're looking for money, you won't excel.
Yeah, you definitely have to do it for the love of it. You got to really, really want it because it's a difficult process to master and a difficult business to navigate as well.
Yeah, it's that old saying, it takes 10,000 hours to do something well. And I think that's an underestimate of what it takes. It's got to be a lifetime of devotion to it. That's how you get to be really good. Everybody that from Philly, from our circle that did well and has continued to do well, everyone has been locked in since we all met as kids. Very few people popped in with overnight success stories and went away. And in our community, that happens a lot in different things, in acting and so on and so forth. But because we were so really focused on the quality level, that is something that takes from time.
Yeah. Good things take time. We need more crock pots and less microwaves, I always say. And so what do you want your musical legacy to be? Like, what do you want to be remembered for most in music? And I'm sure you're going to continue to release music for many, many years to come. But what would you, when it's all said and done, want people to say about you?
No, I locked into the idea that I make people feel good. I like giving people a sense of sensuality and comfort and vibe in the space for them to dream and to imagine and to think beyond where they really are at that moment. Transport people into different places. That's what I like to do.
Awesome. And you definitely do that. And I'm sure you'll continue to do that. As a fan, I could just say, like, your early music, when I was turned on to you, like, I listened to it on repeat so many times. Like, it was so nice to be able to hear and not typical soul artist, if that makes sense, like someone that was introducing me to like elements of like Latin American music and other stuff that like I just had no idea of like what that was. And so it was great to be able to get that, but then also still have all of that like soul and gospel and funk and other stuff, like sensibilities in there that I was familiar with and wanted to know more. So I definitely appreciate that. And thank you for all you've given to the music community. Where can people find you online?
Anything victordupley.com. Well, is my .com up? My .com's under construction, but Victor Duplay, Facebook, Instagram, Spotify, Twitter, or Duplay on Twitter. I don't know. Just Google me.
Nice. And then finally, if people are getting into your catalog and they want to know more about you, like, what should they listen to first?
That's a tricky one. I think if you want to hear what people like about me from a mood perspective, I would say listen to Nothing Like Your Touch on my Bold and Beautiful album, or In the Middle of You, or Make a Baby. But if you wanted to hear the technical production side, I would say listen to Messages, Manhood, maybe Morena, some of those genre-bending songs like that.
Yeah, I think there's definitely both of those albums, International Affairs and Bold and Beautiful, are, I think, top to bottom, people should listen to them. So definitely check those out, everybody, on all the streaming platforms. And be looking for big things to come in 2021. I know we're going to get through COVID and everything, and people are going to be releasing more content. So super excited to have you on, Victor. And again, I'm a super big fan, and hopefully we can keep in touch and I can keep following your illustrious career. But once this is all out in season 4, we'll definitely circle back to you, give you all the links to everything. And we just want to wish you much love.
Much love, and stay safe.
Appreciate it. Have a great one.
You too. Take care.
Peace.
Peace. Thanks again for tuning in to Deeper Grooves, Musicians on Music, hosted by Cliff Beach and sponsored by California Soul Music Record Label. It was fascinating and fun talking with someone who I admire so much as Victor Duplay, talking about his album, Bold and the Beautiful, and more. Man, super, super talented, multi-instrumentalist, DJ, singer-songwriter, producer. He's worked with so many, and I look forward to hearing all of his great music in 2021. I would like to thank our engineer Tim Hall and 1190 Studios for mixing and mastering this recording today. If you like what you hear and you want to hear more, you can check us out online at www.californiasoulmusic.com/deepergrooves or anchor.fm/deepergrooves. Until then, keep it chill vibes. We'll talk to you soon.